is Absolute Rally, powered by the Keel the Works team. Cordless tools tailored for the world of motorsport.
Hello everyone, welcome to Absolute Rally. It is good to be back. Episode 8, Season 16. Did you enjoy your double bubble? Did you enjoy the double podcast? We had some really nice messages. Lots of downloads. Some nice things said about us also on iTunes. If you could rate and review and leave us a little five stars, that does help. I keep saying this, but it is making a hell of a difference to us on various platforms at the moment. So if you could do that, that would be fantastic. For those of you that haven't picked up on the fact that I've shared a couple of things on social media, I was a little bit tied up on the Isle of Man TT last week. Not only there to perhaps partake in some spectating, enjoy some classic road racing on the amazing island, but I also got married. So that's why I was missing last week. And Jack Bengen, nobody knew. It was a big secret. And even Jack Bengen said, well, at least it was a valid reason not to record a podcast last week. So there you go. I hope that's okay with everybody. While we're speaking of Jack Bengen, Ryan Champion, they're not with us as we speak. They're still in Barbados. I'm thinking Club Tropicana, perhaps Wham. That's what I'm thinking of. Not too sure which is which out of him and Ryan Champion. I'll let you work that one out for yourselves. But that means we've got Sense with us this week. We've got Trevor Agnew. Hello, Trev.
Hello, Tony. Mr. Simpson, are you family Simpson? Aren't you the Simpsons?
Yeah, I know.
Congratulations on behalf of everyone.
Thank you, mate. That's really kind of you. But it's back to business. While I was away, I was going to say sunning myself. It wasn't. It was a very rainy Isle of Man. Very, very little racing, unfortunately, though. Things have got underway for this week. But it was very, very sunny, of course, Trev, on Rally Portugal. Now, again, I always say this, Trev, when we record these podcasts, we always work on the proviso that our listeners know results, know where everybody's finished and everything else. And normally we talk about and perhaps dissect the stories a little bit. And would you agree that Rally Portugal will be one perhaps of tactics? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, there are a couple of stories come out of it. One certainly was tactics. I don't know how successful tactics were, actually, for those that maybe didn't see. Hyundai had a couple of issues with Sordo and with Sebastian Loeb on stage 3. Fuel issues, I think it was. Sounded to me like it was the tank getting overheated. And in the past, I've experienced something like that before. Certainly when I saw them release or pull a release cable, it's probably a release pressure in the tank, which means that maybe a breather valve got blocked or wasn't able to function properly. Hence, it creates a vacuum. Hence, the car cuts out. So when they lost those two guys effectively to the rally, then they used them to move about and create a little bit more of a gap between Ogier and Thierry Neuville. So slotting in behind Ogier. So Neuville had two more people clean the road for him. So that was the first part of it. And then, of course, there was a press conference after the rally, where Mr. Ogier alleged a few things that I don't know how true, how accurate they are. I'm 100% sure the conversation happened just on the back of people I've spoke to. There was a conversation about potentially moving Mr. Sordo, so Danny Sordo. And effectively what Ogier was saying was that it might have been occasion or it was talked about that Danny Sordo would start the stage, pull over, which effectively meant that Thierry Neuville, who was running behind him, would have twice the gap that anyone else would have. But if that was the case, then he'd have to pull back out into the stage in Neuville's dust. And clearly you're going to have to leave it for a minute or so so the dust clears, bare minimum. But then that would seriously compromise the person behind, who in that case, on the day that we were talking about, Ogier was talking about, would have been Chris Meek. So that's the allegation. Of course, we've only heard one side of it. I don't know if you've heard anything else about it.
Do you know what? I haven't. And again, I watched the rally, as we all do with WRC Live, and I was watching stuff coming in on Twitter. So I was very much a fan. I didn't speak to anybody over in the service park or anything like that, because I was, of course, away otherwise engaged. But I was keeping up to date with the rally. And again, we're at the stage now where it's exactly the midpoint of the season. We've got the three protagonists that clearly are ahead of the rest. We spoke about this last week, and I think even the week before as well. Would you agree that Andrea Adama had clear clear rights to try and manipulate the results accordingly for his team, because technically it's not breaking a rule as such, is it?
Yeah, for me, it's being creative around the rules. And of course, the others would probably have done the same if they'd got the opportunity and the running order suited them to do it. Something that got, I'm okay. That's stretching the rules. Some people think it's unethical.
I think stopping in the stage is the other stuff we've all seen for years of manipulating road order and stuff like that. But I think physically stopping in a stage to give a teammate a clear run, that's the one that kind of doesn't sit well with me, I'll be honest.
No, definitely not. I'm talking about changing the road order.
Yeah.
So slotting in to change the road order, you crack on, you do it, and that's creative use of the rules. I saw it on the earlier in the year before it got stopped. It was this year, last year on the car stage. But stopping somebody to get them to pull out in front and create a dust storm for somebody, that's dangerous, and that's definitely not going to happen. And I guarantee you that if something like that did happen, the stewards have definitely something to say about it. That is just dangerous, and we definitely don't want to go down that route. And I don't think the top people at Hyundai would be very acceptable to that either. I don't know if that discussion happened. And, we're only speculating here at the end of the day, but if it got to that, if that's the tactics that they were thinking of employing, I don't know if that would have went down very well. Having lived in Japan for 6 months and knowing how Southeast Asian people think a little bit, because of course Toyota had the opportunity to move Latvala and they didn't do that at all during the rally, and they could have had an advantage by moving him, I'd have thought, as well.
Is that because perhaps they didn't, they took their own ethical stance, or is perhaps the fact that they didn't see that opportunity?
Well, we don't know. It is the bottom line. We can speculate as much as we like. It's the same as Sebojia's story. We've heard one side of it. Andrea Adamo vociferously denied it. I suppose he'll continue to deny it. I suppose the only person that could tell the story is Danny Sordo. So if somebody directly asked him, did the discussion take place, then he could either say yes or no. But I imagine there's going to be full denial from Hyundai. I don't know. We're only speculating.
I guess is this, and again, to the psychology side of it for me also comes in, and you don't start speaking about your rivals until you see them as rivals. And is this an instance where perhaps Seb might be rattled a little bit, and he's now seeing this threat from Hyundai a lot more serious than perhaps he's seen it before, or am I just overthinking it?
Overthinking it, I'd say, Tony. And you're not rattle that man. He's run first in the road, and his attitude and the way he copes with that is the same way he coped with the threat. I don't think it was much of an advantage. In fact, I don't understand why they did that and then they sent Neuville out with two spare wheels on Saturday afternoon. That was a strange decision. So he's the only one with carrying an extra 25 kilos. Of course, there is an advantage if he can fit different compound tyres or fresh tyres to the last stage. And we've seen him do that in the past to good effect. But I don't think on that rally it was the wisest strategy. But either way, I think there was only a difference of 1 second over the difference between leg one and leg two. It didn't change much between Ogier and Neuville.
I suppose if we are talking about tactics, and as ever, we do things arse about face, if I can use that expression. On one side, we've just talked about perhaps allegedly the negative side to tactics and things like that. But I think the stroke of genius on the tactics for me was Tanak finishing the power stage.
Yeah, again, I'm not convinced it's a great strategy. I understood exactly why they did it, but they've shipped 2 points. So there's 2 points. If the title goes the way it went last year, then that could be quite vital towards the end of the year. The other thing, of course, is not to say there ain't going to be a thunderstorm before we start Sardinia. So if the roads are wet in Sardinia, you definitely want to be first on the road there. So yeah, it'll be interesting if it plays out.
I'm not entirely sure whether I'm sure they were trying to work it so it was only a point. And it was a 0.6 of a second out or something like that. So that's how it ended up being the 2 points. But, to have that I suppose it's presence of mind, and I suppose that time to be able to discuss it in advance, isn't it? Because this is the thing, I suppose, we from a fan point of view, and of course, Trev, you've been in the eye of the storm. I've not quite been in the eye of the, in the storm competition-wise, but certainly behind the scenes, I work with teams and stuff like that. But, you know, most fans don't really realise what goes on in the porter cabins or the well, they're not porter cabins anymore, rally buildings that they have in service parks. You know, some of these things that are going on with brain trusts. You know, all these teams now, don't they, Trev? They have a brain trust, and somebody will be looking at the FIA regulations, and somebody will be looking at timings, and somebody will be looking at compound. You know, the brain trust behind running this operation now just seems to be getting more and more layers to it as the seasons go by.
Yeah, and this precedence is set for some of these before, and it's not that hard to sit down. Certainly there were plenty of Excel spreadsheets floating about when I was competing. And when it gets to these types of things, there are certainly creative people in each of the teams that can come up with ideas. You think of Phil Short, George Donaldson all those years ago, were people who are master tacticians, I should say, when it came to that. It's interesting, they're both finishing on the same points. Now, I don't know what the regulations say. I assume it's the person who finished highest on the last rally goes first. So that's why, as you know, they're a point, they're 2 points apart. But if they had finished on the same points, in other words, if Tanak had kept the boot in and they finished on the same championship points at the end of it, in other words, if he had 5 points in that, I don't know what way that would have worked. But again, yeah, there's lots of different ways to think about it. People can be clever, but sometimes it does backfire.
Yeah, now if we can look at the results as a whole, you know, we I think we were all looking for a result for Chris. We all thought Chris was going to get the result, and we don't quite know what, well, we do know what went on, a tree stump went on, but it all went from being probably the drive of his short Toyota career so far to being another one of those old Chris moments.
I'll go with the former. I think it was the drive of his Toyota career so far, and his performance was absolutely brilliant on the whole weekend, bar those 2 mistakes towards the end of it. Remember, he did have his frustrations as well. He did a stage in the first morning, or the first day anyway, with the Wintercom. Didn't slow him down much then. Yeah, the woes and the frustrations of being a Chris Meek fan, of which I am definitely one. We go back to the same thing. Tony has his concentration issues, his focus issue that is tripping him up. But that's as close as I've seen him to the form that he was in 2016 when he was in that in the DS3 World Rally Car. And you remember his performances in Portugal. I was there. He blitzed everybody. It was so relaxed. So he's becoming to get like that. The car is part of him, and he's feeling more and more relaxed. And he'll start to do the laugh and the joking a little bit more at the end of the stages. And when he's in that form, then it's going to be a big race between him and Tanak, because Tanak on that rally was exceptional. You know, to run second on the road and set the times that he set and have the issues that he had as well, to get all that behind him and not lose the head and refocus again. And remember, right on Sunday morning before Chris did make his mistakes, there's only a couple of seconds in it. Of course, team orders would probably come into play after that. And that's the situation that Chris is up against. You know, if Tanak is running behind him at any point during the year, then that could happen now. But it goes back to the same thing that we talked about many times. You've got to have your teammates covering you. Yet again, the top three, Neuville, Ogier, and Tanak have no support in our teammates in this event, really.
Just with regards to what you've just been saying about Chris, do you think this is a unique position for Chris as well? That in many ways, Chris has always clearly been seen as if not one of the fastest rally driver currently at WRC level, but you know, the way circumstances have worked out for him and luck and all these other things, and you've got your own thoughts on luck, but clearly at Toyota, Oit Tanak is the fastest driver.
Yeah, he is, and that's right, because he's had an extra year in the car over Chris. You know, Chris has built up his speed. He's been very wise this year in that, you know, this is the first time he hasn't finished a rally, I think, isn't it? So he's built his pace up in a more measured way. he still has had these lapses in concentration. That's something, you know, I'm on record plenty of times saying that I would personally like him to look at that and see if there's any patterns that he can address and really give us fans just that. We don't have to sit on the last day of our rally and keep our fingers crossed and hope that everything's going to be right. Because, as I say, when he can get back to that feeling that he had in 2016, then it becomes effortless for him. And he's close to that. But, again, just keep an eye on those lapses in concentration. See if you can find a way or at least find a pattern. And maybe you can address things differently on the recce or on the rally. You know, on the last day, did he need to be cutting up much? And, you know, we could have lots of negatives around, but I want to be really positive on Chris Meek because as someone who comes from Northern Ireland, we're absolutely thrilled to have somebody that can fight at the top. But you're right, Oit Tanak at the minute in that Toyota is the fastest. Ogier is consistently brilliant. And Neuville seems to be dialing in that Hyundai quite well now. Three of them championship again. And it's up to Chris for the rest of the year to definitely score as many podiums as he can. And if he can nick in there and get a win, if something happens to Tanak, then that's definitely would be a big, big move forward for him and Toyota this year and really put him in good stead for retaining the seat for next year.
No, I couldn't agree more. I just, as I say, just to finish on Chris, really, just that spin that he had, which caught out Lappy, put Lappy on his roof, of course, on that same hairpin. He dropped, I think, 16, 17 seconds. I just felt he was chasing that and possibly chasing it just a little bit too much. I think that was probably the difference, but as I say, it was just one of those moments where I was watching the times coming in. You know, I think we're all rooting to see Chris get a result, and you know, long may it continue. As I say, if he can prolong his career in WRC, it was interesting watching some of the stage ends retrospectively, and I think to one of the phrases he used on the Saturday, where it was, you know, this time last year I was on my way to hospital. And I've just been sacked from my job. So today's pretty good, you know, and that's the Chris that we want. That's the Chris that we long to see, because that's the strongest Chris when he's in that particular frame of mind, as you say. Just moving on to kind of the other runners and riders, Trev. We've got Gus Greensmith joining us a little bit later on the podcast. Just a moment on him, really. First time in a competitive seat. I wrote some things on my pad, which I put to Gus. I've known him a long time, so I could kind of... The three things I wrote on my pad before I knew I was going to talk to him, Trev, was solid, steady, and sensible.
Yeah, we spoke to Christian Solberg earlier in the year to find out what the strategy was. I wasn't convinced they had a brilliant strategy back then. For me, I was expecting them to go out, get to learn the car on the first day and then start to push and set times the second day. But I think from the start, if you look at his times in the first morning, they were very, very good. And it was probably one of the best performances I've seen from somebody coming in that has no real level of experience in that car, none at all, really. One test or one day's testing before. And his performance was great. He'd be delighted with it. He loves the event. He loves the stages, certainly on the Saturday. And then he'd just slip in Amarante. Amarante is a stage that's caught many people out. So, you know, that happens in that stage. The type of surface is on there is very slippery and the grip's inconsistent. So that was a mistake on his behalf, which ended Saturday. Then Sunday, I don't know what happened there. I'd be interested to find out what he said. But certainly going over the jump, the front left wheel had a load of camber, or sort of a load of turn in. So it was towed in. Both sides were towed in. So it was going to go. There was no steering effectively when he landed after the jump. Whether that happened on the compression before the jump or not, I don't know. But certainly he was never going to be able to control that car when it landed after the fast jump.
Gus will tell us all about it a little bit later on. As you say, I was just really pleased to from his point of view. You know, he has gone through this, and we will talk about this with Gus, so I don't really want to cover it too much, but he has gone through this kind of ladder of opportunity and almost like this kind of pin-up, almost like Elvin, you know, starting off in R1 cars and kind of ticking the boxes, working the way up. And, you know, those people are very few and far between, Trev, aren't they? You know, the ones that kind of start in the very, very basic model of a car and work the way all the way up to the current spec of that World Rally car. You know, I do see him as a little bit of a poster boy for M Sport, and hopefully, you know, it's a long time, I think, Trev, since we've had, you know, without getting without getting too parochial on this, but obviously I'm trying to think, when was the last time we had an Englishman in the top 10 of WRC? Would it have been Richard?
Who else is on the train? I don't know. Chris, did Chris finish 8th in Turkey? No, where was he? Chris Ingram? No,
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, it's been a while. You're right. You know, to have that ladder right away through M Sport is great. You know, to see people like that, and even Tannock down at point came through some of it. To see that, I think, is great. But it's just such a challenge now to be able to go from even an R5 car into a World Rally car. The costs involved, remember, if you look at the top, there's not that many paid seats at the end of it to get your investment back if you are investing in a young driver. And just the numbers are incredible now. So to have somebody that can find a way of doing that is brilliant news, and long may it continue. But for me, that was one of the downsides of the 2017 cars, was we've lost all the privateers, bar one or two exceptions. You know, you can imagine if you'd R5 cars and everybody competing, you won't have the same spec as the factory cars. You won't have the same engines, for example, but you could certainly make an impression. And that bit's gone, but, you know, we've done that plenty of times, haven't we, over the podcast?
Absolutely. Another young man, again, fantastic performance on its first WRC event was Cali Rovanperä in the new Skoda R5. Is it going to be... Are we going to be rushing this young man, Trev? Are we going to see him in a world car next year? Do you think that's going to happen?
Maybe even this year. Who knows? He will be in a world rally car sooner than later. And the other person that won't be that far behind him will be Oliver Solberg. You know, you look at the experience those guys have in cars and driving cars. So they learned to drive and trade, if you like, that art. And now it's just a matter of getting the mental side of it sorted, the consistency, and being able to drive with their heads. It's inevitable at some point they're both going to be in World Rally cars, isn't it?
It is a really strong entry on Portugal for R5 cars, and seeing some you know, Emil Bergqvist, and you know, of course, went through the DMAC thing as well, but seeing some of the older generations, Jan Kopecky coming back, Henning Solberg, who just always seems to find budget from somewhere. It was an incredibly strong R5 entry, Trev, for an event. And you know, again, when I was watching some of the onboards and looking at some of the roundups from the XNWRC Live, stages look incredibly rough. You know, ruts looked really tough. So it was a surprise for me to see, well, apart from the fact there was a load of R2 cars there as well, but there was a surprise for me to see such a strong R5 entry with exactly what you've just said.
Because it's an iconic event and everybody wants to do it, and they seem to be able to get the budget to do those Western European events. So, and you think of all the different regions and countries that are involved that can get importers to help them with that. The R5 class is very, very strong. We know that. We've talked about it plenty of times. And, it's just going to be interesting with how we're going to develop the regulations to make it good for a spectacle. And I go back to what I said, if you watch Chris Meek or even Ogier in the 2016 season, certainly Rally Finland, those cars are spectacular enough without loading them up with a load more aero. It costs a fortune to replace and repair as you go through the event. So, I think we've done that one, haven't we?
We have. One thing that does seem to be coming back around on R5 cars is Volkswagen Polos and Fire.
Yeah, five of them, is that right?
I read something similar. Now, I don't know too much about this, Trev, to be perfectly honest with you, but I'm really hesitant to actually expand upon more than these and just saying it out loud, because it is a fact and nobody can dispute that fact, but that's a really, really high number. It'd be interesting to see, I don't know how many are in privateers' hands or how many are out there competing, but there can't be actually that many that haven't been affected by this now that surely have been sold, because, of course, they weren't selling them in the way Skoda were and the way M Sport were, where they were pushing them out the door and, you know, they were up to hundreds and hundreds of sales. It was very much a you were almost like the chosen one to get one of these Volkswagen Polo R5s. So there's not like there's lots of them out there, but, you know, a stat of five of them going up in flames is really troubling.
I'm sure I saw the other day that sold 30 of them, so there are a few more maybe than you've expected to be out there. But even with that, 5 from 30, you're rolling your dice there, aren't you? It seems to be around the rear of the car. Whichever one caught fire, was it Camelys caught fire at the weekend?
It was Christian Ole Wiebe.
Oh, Christian Wiebe, yeah. So he managed to get to a fire truck or a fire, certainly a marshal quite quickly, so they saved the car, and that will help them. They're calling in FX has said that they're bringing in a forensic team to help them investigate where the fire started. And
well,
that
a second one went up as well, Trev. I've just clicked on the results as well, retirements, and there was a second Polo that went on fire for Pedro Morelles. Obviously one of the Portuguese drivers. Well, that's two on that one rally.
Well, exceptionally hot, of course, isn't going to help it in those situations. But yeah, it's an issue. They're clearly no better team to try and sort it and get to the down here. But as you know, trying to insure these cars or something like that happens and insurance companies get wind of it, then it's going to make it a little bit more difficult.
Do you know what? I don't know whether people actually try and bother insuring these days. It's very, very expensive. I always insured cars when I drove them, to be honest with you. And just, I can't even imagine that what it's like to try and get insurance covered on an R5 car. I wouldn't even like to hesitate. You know, you can get insurance and there's people who offer insurance, but when it comes to paying the claim out, I can always remember a story, Trev. And it was, it was a Super 2000 car. I'm going to be really careful where I go with this. It was a Super 2000 car that went up in flames and the insurance didn't pay out because the first point of impact before the car went on flames was the bumper being damaged because the car had ran wide and there was footage of it running wide. So they were only prepared to pay out for the bumper.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. Nope. So, I'm going to be really careful where I go with that because I'm going to be careful who told me it. But that was basically what happened and they didn't get paid out on the car. So, I'd hate to be in that position because, anyway, let's not even think about that. Trevor, is there anything else you want to cover from Portugal?
No, I think that's most of it done. So Toyota, you got Latvala, who had his issue again. It was run very strong. Yeah, Matty was, but... You know, he's the one that seems to have the issues. Of course, Tanaka had the same thing with a broken shock absorber at the front of the car. So from that point of view, Hyundai, Neville, as I said, has dialed himself into that car. He's getting quicker. But again, just didn't get off to the right start this time. And Lappi, God, what we'll say about him. We've said it all before the rally, and he was having a strong performance, and then he's just messed up again. Yeah, difficult. The Fords were run quite well, Sunderland and Elvin. But again, both had issues with the cars. Certainly Elvin lost 4 minutes. And that's Cooper's his chance of a podium, really, because he could have been up there.
Yeah. I think that they had a problem. There was obviously an electrical gremlin that kicked in. And I think Timu had something similar with the car misfiring or something like that. And obviously we know, well, we'll hear about Gus's weekend a little bit later on in the podcast. So that's great. That's great. Folks, what we're going to do, we're going to go to a little break. I'm going to come back with Gus Greensmith. And then after that, Trevor and I are going to come back with our other businesses.
This is Absolute Rally with Kielde. Whether it's the car, the service, the tools, the mechanics matter.
There's 15 more seconds to fill.
That's it, Tony. Car sounds?
And welcome back to the next section of Absolute Rally. As I mentioned at the top of the program, obviously post-nuptials for me now. So I thought I'd get somebody else to see just basically how their weekend was, really, just see what they got up to. Gus Greensmith, how are you doing? What you got up to the weekend, mate?
I had a plane crash.
Did you?
Yeah, dearie,
mate. What happened, mate? Talk us through it.
Well, I took off, and then as I was coming down for landing, some of my landing gear didn't seem to want to work.
Right.
And we had a bit of a crash, really.
Oh dear. You see, I really wanted to get you on to talk about the Midsummer Kerwin's Junior stages in 2013.
Yeah.
In a Nissan Micra.
Yeah.
But that was your first rally, and I really we should probably talk about your last rally, obviously. Post landing, post everything now, 48 hours after the event, you're now back at home. Reflections in all joking aside on your weekend, mate. I'm going to give you my reflections of what I thought in a minute, but I want yours because you're harder on you than anybody could ever be. So go on, what's yours?
Well, I would call it a fairly solid first weekend in a WRC car. I'd say it was pretty good. The first day was just completely new stages, completely new car, only one day of testing, big thing to live up to. And we first stage, we were faster than 16 world championships. So I patted myself on the back for that. And then, yeah, it just progressed from there. And then the second day, we were swapping and trading times with my experienced teammates. So for me, it felt like a pretty good weekend. And Sunday... obviously cleaning the road, that was something new, but even then the time seemed pretty good in comparison. And then I took off, came down for landing, and it all went a bit pear-shaped then.
I'll tell you what I wrote on my pad now, and I'm not being an after-timer here. Before we started recording this, I wrote solid, steady, sensible. Three S's.
Yeah,
would you agree with that?
I'd certainly probably go along the lines of that. I think to be swapping times with Elvin Evans and Timo Sunderland for a first attempt, I'd call that a bit better than steady. But generally, yeah, it was just every kilometre I did, I got better and carried on progressing through the weekend. And in the end, I would say, not bad.
No, absolutely. Listen, I'm going to qualify steady. And what you're doing, because you're here, if you look at your, on each stage, I did a bit of a stage analysis, and it was 8th, 9th, 10th, 8th, 9th, 10th. I think the lowest stage time you put in was 11th. Where I got steady from was, for me, when I looked at it, I was looking at the factory cars, if you like. So there's two Citroens, there's three Toyotas, there's three high-end eyes, and obviously 2M Sport and yourself, so 3M. So in my head, if you were somewhere behind the fully fledged works guys and somewhere around Timu, I thought that was going to be a great weekend for you, but you were ahead of that. Now, you can always say circumstances kind of come into play. Of course they did, but that's the game, isn't it? That's the game. So before you started, Gus, because I know you love a benchmark and I know you have to set yourself markers and stuff like that, where did you put Gus Greensmith's marker?
Pretty much where I ended up, to be honest. I knew that the first day would be important, but we had a good road position. But obviously, a couple of team orders and a couple of wise heads telling me just get through the day, learn. The second day for me was possibly the best because we were pretty much identical road position with my teammates. Cleaning was massive on Saturday. So obviously going against the guys that were fighting to the wind was never going to be realistic. So for me, the only thing to gauge against on the Saturday was Aspekalapi and my two teammates. And I was swapping times with them, beating some of them throughout the day. So for me, that was pretty solid for a time where I was still getting to grips with the car, learning a couple of things. So yeah, seemed pretty good.
How did the team meetings go? Because obviously, you know, I always say this, and it's not just because I say it, because obviously I've known Rich for a long time. And how does a meeting go? Because Rich is your boss. How does that go when you sit down and talk to Rich? What's Rich saying to you at that point?
He says very little to me because he doesn't need to say much to me. I think we all knew what I had to do. It wasn't rocket science. Obviously, we wanted to see some good times. I delivered on my first attempt, so I think everyone was happy. There's obviously quite a lot to work on. You can see why drivers are as quick as they are, but then again, nothing seemed like anything that I couldn't do. So basically, it was good to get that first rally under the belt, understand how things work, understand what I need to do better, and then my second attempt should be more consistent, even faster than the first one.
Can I ask you about notes? Because that's something you've worked on quite a lot over the last probably two, three years, obviously, with Craig and now with Elliot as well, and Craig still obviously in the background. That jump from the R5 car, I'm not going to ask the lazy question because everybody asks the same question of you, and I'm really, really aware of it, joking aside. But the amendment to notes, was there much changes to your notes? Did you have to dramatically speed up your notes to kind of correspond with being in a 17 spec car?
No, I actually slowed them down and made them more simple. I basically found that everything comes at you so fast, everything you perceive just seems a little bit of a tighter angle because it's coming at you so much quicker. So for me, it was always important to be on the side of caution than too aggressive. And then I just worked on making them flow, making my like kind of unique system of speeds on corners work. And then I drew in the vast experience of Mr. Craig Parry again to help with the transition. And for me, probably the best thing of the weekend was the pace notes. I probably made 5 changes in the entire weekend. I barely had to do anything. So for me, the preparation, it seems I've been working on it for 6 months, and obviously working with Craig and Elliot as well, did an incredible job. I couldn't have asked for anything better. He didn't make a single mistake all weekend. So for me, the pace notes went really well.
I was just about to say, because, you know, it wasn't just the first time for you, it was the first time for Elliot as well, wasn't it? You know, that's also forgotten about, because normally what happens is that there's normally at least one of the crew that's been in this position before, but of course it wasn't. It was the same for you guys across the board, really. So to both go into it into the unknown, okay, you've done a test. I suppose having Craig there was just a massive help leading up to this.
Yeah, no, it was, and Craig helped massively. And like I said, I'll always be using Craig's experience as much as I can because it's so vast. So for me, anytime I can get hold of Craig's benefit, and whenever I do get hold of him, everything seems to work out just as I planned.
Good man. Moving forward, what happens now with regards to debrief with the team and everything else? Because obviously you're used to this now, of course. This is the other thing, of course. You've been growing up in the M-Sport environment. You could argue all the way from, obviously, the DMAC Drive days, you know, because obviously that's run by M-Sport as well. So you've grown up rally-wise in M-Sport. Do you sit down this week with engineers? How does it work now, looking back at stage times? Obviously, what happened as well? What happens next? Because I'm fascinated by this as well.
This was all done on Sunday. This is all done immediately after the rally when everything's as fresh as it can be in the mind. Sit down together as a team, engineers, team managers, principals, sit down. We debrief everything, everything's fresh in our minds, and then we look at what needs to be better, what was good. We do it as collectively as a team, which is a little bit different compared to how I do things in WRC2. But clearly in the P1 team, everything's shared and it's a collective group effort at the end of the day.
How was it with regards to teammates? Because I guess that's something else which is new for you as well. Because, you know, in every other aspect of your competitive life so far, especially with rallying, of course, you don't have teammates, or you haven't had teammates because you've either been self-run or you've been DMAC Drive, or obviously doing the R5 program. Obviously, you're still in competition, but obviously, clearly, you've got teammates that you can bounce upon and share data with and things like that. How helpful was it having that little bit more experience from the likes of Elvin and from Timu as well?
Yeah, the main thing for me was having access to the setups, because obviously these cars are just, I don't think people appreciate exactly how much of a step up these cars are. And I think we've seen some other drivers try and make the step and it just didn't work. So there's so many things that you need to take into consideration when you do go into these cars. They're so much faster. There's aerodynamics, central differential, then there's the pace notes. Everything changes completely. So for me, I wanted to make the weekend as simple as possible. So I used every bit of information and data I could get from my two teammates. I tried to put it together and then made it comfortable for myself. So for me, having them was really important. And to be honest, they were really helpful in trying to help my transition into the car as easy as possible, which is something that doesn't happen often. So, yeah, pretty thankful to those two for giving me some advice. And I'm fairly sure sometime in the future, if I carry on, it'll start reducing as time goes on.
You're very similar in many ways, of course, to Elvin. And what I mean is by that, and you and I have spoke about this before, this Ford ladder, you know, I just joking aside, I looked at your first rally before specifically just to kind of get a gauge of time wise and, you know, the Nissan Micra. But when it starts getting a bit serious, we're in a Fiesta R1 and we've done R2, R2T, R5, and now we call them 17 spec cars, but you know, they're a 19 spec car, obviously, because everything keeps progressing with them. But now you've gone through that ladder and that tick box of the Ford Fiesta family. So do you feel like that, you know, you are kind of like this Ford boy through and through now, aren't you?
Yeah, I am the greatest M Sport poster boy they could ever wish for. I literally did the exact ladder without driving any other car. So yeah, no, M Sport has been a fantastic place to have been, to start my career as self-run, to then go as a privateer, to then be a factory driver, and then be a WRC driver. It's been a really strong progression throughout, and they've just been the access to the facilities that they've given me is something that I will never be able to repay them for, but at least now I'm putting in the performances which justifies the trust in me.
Now, moving forward, we've got a little bit of downtime now, because what's your program now? Where are we next?
Oh, there's no downtime. I have about 3 days before I'm heading back to Sardinia. So there's not much downtime at all. But for me, back to WRC2 Pro for Sardinia, a nice summer break feels like it's needed, because it doesn't feel like it's stopped. And then, we go back. We have the new car from Finland, the new WRC2 car, which I'm really looking forward to. And then, yeah, I'm sure there's going to be at least another outing in a lovely 17 spec car.
Can I ask you about something that happened on the rally? It's not the obvious thing. It was more of a, I think I've seen one of your stage end interviews, which are always great. With regards to road cleaning, you know, you mentioned it before how the road was clean. It was the first time you'd been first on the road in a wheel car. And again, you said, you know, to coin a phrase you said previously, people don't quite understand perhaps what driving a 17 car goes like. But nobody probably understands, you know, the complaints, I suppose, what some WRC drivers have had over the years of being first on the road and this cleaning effect. Did you gain a little bit of an appreciation, perhaps, of why some of these drivers over the last 4 or 5 years have perhaps raised their concerns about this road cleaning and what goes on and how it can affect championships?
It's a tough question to give an answer to, because no matter what format you use for road position, someone's always going to be complaining. Someone always will be complaining, and it's never going to change. So for me, I feel like the way it works at the moment is best. I think it condenses the field a lot, and it helps to provide a better championship. Yeah, I can understand the championship leaders are going to complain, but then the championship leaders, for a reason, they're supposed to be the best drivers in the world. They're supposed to be able to deal with it. Oi can clearly deal with it. So for me, you can understand why it's frustrating, because when I clean the road, you have to be very clean, very tidy. You can just feel that you're losing time every single corner, just cleaning a line for everyone else. So it is frustrating, but that's just the way rallying is. Then these guys that complain about road order, they go lead the championship, they go to tarmac, and they've got a nice clean road. So it's a win-lose situation no matter where you go. So for me, it works.
Okay, from a bit of a fanboy point of view now, I'm going to ask you the question. Did you allow yourself a moment to pinch yourself, Gus? And I'm going to...
Sorry, say that again.
Did you allow yourself a moment to pinch yourself in this? And the reason why I'm going to say this is because we've known each other quite a while now. And I remember talking to you whether I can't even remember whether we recorded or whether it was just a conversation we had, but talking about you watching Monte Carlo and watching Loeb, that was where the inspiration came from to perhaps not go racing, but to go rallying. And then here yourself, that here you are last weekend, you're in a control seat of a few cars behind Sebastian Loeb.
Yeah. And on the first stage when I beat him, I pinched myself. I was kind of like, kind of giddy after that happened. So yeah, it was fairly surreal. I think that's the best way to put it. I tried to stay calm and collected and focus and do my job. But the end of the day, like I said many times before the event and on pretty much every stage and interview, it's just incredible. It's just the most fun you could ever have. It's the most exhilarating feeling I've ever had. And although obviously the times were good in comparison to those around me, but you can understand why some drivers say you have to be scared of dying if you want to drive these cars as fast as they can go.
Wow, there's a line which doesn't sit well with me, I'll be honest with you. But moving on, obviously, as you've just mentioned, we've got a couple of days before you do go off to Sardinia. When you got out of the 17 car the last time you did a test and then got back in an R5 car, did the R5 feel incredibly easy to drive again, or did it actually feel harder?
No, it's harder. It's a more physical way of driving. The car does less for you. You have to make it work a little bit more. So yeah, it's different. The actual brain capacity required to drive a WRC2 car is nothing like what it is to drive a WRC car. But then again, they're not quite as strong. They're not as fast. You have to be more aware of the car itself. So it's a different way of driving. And there's obviously the speed. The speed's a lot lower. And we know that R5s aren't generally slow either. So it's... It'll be a weird transition, especially next Monday on the test. It'll feel strange and won't feel as nice, but I still remember the times when I was in R2 and I would have given absolutely anything to have driven an R5. So I'm not complaining at all. I'm in a very lucky situation.
I've got to ask how your dad is now, because that cut to that image of your dad over the weekend where he's obviously watching you over Faf and obviously... You take off, and as to coin the phrase, the landing gear didn't quite work at the top of this particular piece. How is your dad now? Because he's been with you every step of the way. I can remember seeing your dad, you know, cleaning windscreens and swapping wheels and stuff like that. So he's been on this journey with you as well. It's an amazing journey, and I love it. I love the fact that he's there with you. How is he now? Because obviously he must have had that roller coaster of emotions as well.
Yeah, well, I think he was proud, I would certainly say. Any driver that takes on and beats on stages, drivers like Timo Sunen and Elvin Evans, it's a big thing. And obviously, it was a big moment for me and him, because we were going to find out whether we had what it took to carry on in my career and whether it was realistic that I would get somewhere one day. And if I could do it on my first go, then I'm fairly sure I'm going to be able to do it from now on. So it was important for us. And my dad felt really proud. I was really proud. Obviously, there was quite a few things that I would like to improve on. But generally, it clearly answered a lot of questions, answered a lot of people's questions or a lot of people's doubts, whatever you want to call it. And for me, that was an important thing. And for him, I think it was too.
Brilliant. Brilliant. We'll send them our best anyway. Send them our best. I'm going to let you go and continue your 3 days of rest now, Mr. Greensmith. And I think I've tried not to ask you any obvious questions.
No, you've done a good job, to be fair.
Thanks, mate. Thanks, mate. I thought I'd do a little bit. Can you come back and talk to us again soon?
Of course I will.
All right. Folks, that was Gus Greensmith. Fantastic effort of the weekend. Congratulations to Gus. We'll be back after this break.
This is Absolute Rally.
Quarter, mid-lift crest, 8-6 right, minus, tightens over jump, opens over 50, sharp left, tightens 5-6 over left crest, over 70, 5 right.
Ireland's leading commercial note supplier, Killian Duffy, has joined forces with 2016 British Rally champion Craig Parry to form On The Pace Note UK. For more information, visit the website onthepacenote.co.uk.
Welcome back to the final section of Absolute Rally. We are getting to the point of near the end of the season. The guys at Kielder obviously are keen supporters. I've put out the competition. We've got loads now, by the way, of right answers. We've got one or two wrong ones. The mugs will be getting awarded at the end of this particular season, in case you're wondering, where are mugs? When are you announcing the winners? We decided to let this one run through. So we'll still be announcing winners on episode 10 of this particular season, which is, of course, the last episode of season 16. So you've still got a chance to get your answers in. Anyway, it's got to the section now. What I didn't do, Trev, by the way, at the top of the podcast, I didn't do Gary Boyd's facts. Now.
Oh, that's
yeah. Gary always sends us something. He sent me well wishes for getting married. But a little bit of a stat for you, because he's good for this. A stat for this week. 812 driver points awarded so far this year. Top three drivers have 414 points between them. Everybody else has 398 between them.
Mm-hmm. Shows there you the
go. Difference. It does. It does, and it kind of shows what I was mentioning the other week with regards to the clear, almost, to coin that phrase from football terms, the Champions League, UEFA Cup kind of era, and then the relegation zone, perhaps, dare I say, the difference of where the drivers are right now. So there you go. So that was one of Gary Boyd's facts. Want to do a little bit of any other business. Mine, by the way, and it's not really in any other business, but Rally Portugal, Trev, right, got me thinking. It's obviously got a different sponsor now and things like that, but it got me thinking of event sponsors. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, over here, we're going to talk about, ironically, Rally GB very, very shortly, but for all intents and purposes in this country, it was the Lombard RAC Rally. That's what everybody knew it as. And still to this day, people will still refer to that if they're talking about rallying or they haven't been around rallying for a little while. But for me, Portugal was always the tap. Rally Portugal, Trev.
Yeah, after the national airline, of course. If you go to Rally Portugal in the service park, it's in Matosinhos, and it's in like a big leisure complex. And I remember, I think it must have been 16, they had a rule. Complete every single door plate from every rally in Rally Portugal down one wall. It's fascinating just to see the different door plates and how it evolved over the years. That's definitely one. And it's interesting, they used some of the stages around Arganil. The last time that they used those is in 2001. And I remember because we were over there trying to do a negotiate a deal for us to use the World Rally Car for the rest of the year. And it was a very wet rally. You remember that one where it was absolutely treacherous with people going off left, right and centre?
Yeah.
That was the last time they were in those classic stages around Argonneil. But you're right. It's just been one that you always love watching on telly. That 1981 in particular is a fantastic year. And, it brings back memories, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's just as I say, these rally names we kind of obviously we still talk about the Rally of Finland, the Thousand Lakes and stuff like that. There's still people who will know about those, and whether it's clever marketing or whatever. Obviously, Finland's probably not a great example, but Tap Rally Portugal for me. It's still sponsored by that particular airline, and they probably haven't sponsored the Trev for what 10 years, maybe 15 years.
Quite a long time anyway, yeah.
So anyway, it just goes to show how long these associations go on for with rallies and stuff like that. But you went on with us the other week, and of course, talking about WRC rounds, and I've just mentioned, of course, Lombard RAC Rally and things like that, but it's currently known as Wales Rally GB. Under threat, Trev, with regards to possibly moving out of Wales, but of course, to your homeland. What was your take on that story, Trev?
Yeah, well, it's going to be my any other business just to bring it up. I heard the conversation that Brian and you had on the show either last week or the week before, and it's something that's been niggling away at me. And there was an article, a news analysis piece that David Evans put in Motorsport News last week, and literally using your words there, the very real threat that could derail Rally GB. So it's really surmising that the future of Britain's round of the World Championship, it's unclear, and we need some really quick thinking to try and save it, because there are plenty of other events that are circling and would very, very happily steal that spot on the calendar. We're guaranteed one right through to 2020 at the minute, but of course the promoters already said that they want to know which part of the UK it's going to be in. And David starts off his article quite quite feisty. He says anybody who doesn't understand the considerable threat to Britain's future in the World Rally Championship is, I'm afraid, delusional. It's that simple, that straightforward. And so basically what he's saying is, you know, we've got to crack on and get something done. There's certainly no secret that Northern Ireland are very, very interested in hosting a round of the World Rally Championship. For those that don't know, we're hosting the Open, which is the golf tournament. So one of the four majors of the golf tournament this year in Portrush, in Portrush. Of course, there's been investment for the government by that. But I think a rally in Northern Ireland will far surpass that without any doubt in my mind whatsoever. So that particular event, the Open, is focused on one part and really targeted in one part of Northern Ireland. As I understand it, every single council in the whole of the province is on board to try and get a round of the World Rally Championship to Northern Ireland. The stages we know are going to be exceptional. Bobby Willis is the guy who's trying to drive it, or is driving it, and trying to get the government to commit to it. And I think it's a very viable proposition. We've got the best roads. We've got two drivers who are, you know, World Championship definitely, and Craig Breen and Chris Meek, of course. We've got the infrastructure as regards hotels. And I think it's definitely a goer. It'd be interesting to run a round of the World Championship in Northern Ireland, have it on tarmac for a change. You know, in the article that David's saying, that fair enough, Wales have a contract in place, but we've got Hugh Chambers, who's the chief executive of Motorsport UK, in other words, the promoter and the government body. They run the event, and he reckons between 3 million and 3.5 million it takes to run Britain's round. But Wales, we know, according to David's article anyway, that their contribution to the government of Wales is less than 1 million. So how you square that circle without an event sponsor, I don't know. But time's running out. I think it needs to happen very quickly. You know, from what I can see between the lines, something that needs to be decided, certainly by the end of September, as to whether it's going to Northern Ireland or not. I suppose if you spoke to Motorsport UK, they'll probably point to the fact that there's no government in Northern Ireland. The Assembly hasn't sat since January 2017. Also, with Brexit going on, it's a bit difficult to get a decision in Westminster as to whether the government's going to commit the funding to it or not. But I'm on the flip side of that. I'm thinking there's a really good opportunity in the back of all of that to do something that's absolutely going to showcase Northern Ireland in the right way, to attract a load more people into the country, on the back of what we're going to do with the Open, on the back of what we've done with Game of Thrones. And I think with the right determination, with the right attitude, and going about it the right way, with a degree of determination to crack on, let's do this, let's not make excuses for not doing it, that it will happen. You know, I certainly, from the people I spoke to, there's a real, real drive for Northern Ireland to have it, if we can just get this decision made in time for the event to run in 2020. My fear is, if it doesn't go to Northern Ireland in 2020, it might not run in Wales. If we lose it, and it's going to be very, very hard to get back into the World Championship game, as I see it.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I don't want to lose it from where it is, because it works very well for me from a very selfish point of view. It's like having, you know, I've got a WRC event literally on my doorstep. And in this year, obviously, it's starting on my doorstep. But, you know, moving away from that, I've just come back from the Isle of Man and you know, watching, close road motorbikes, you know, which is an amazing experience. But of course, the Northwest 200 is a massive event in motorcycle road racing as well.
Yeah, we've got 100,000 people who come to that. You know, a lot of people come into the country and bringing friends that haven't been to for the first time. And I think that's something that we can do really well. And we've proven that in the past. If you look at what Bobby Willis has done with the Circuit of Ireland name, bringing it alive again, being part of the European Rally Championship, and then the following year, ERC and the British Rally Championship with 30-some-odd R5 cars. But not only that, it's an opportunity to showcase Northern Ireland in the same way, and that's what Eurosport are very good at, showcase in the same way as we see if you follow the Tour de France or any of the major cycle races. As they go through each of the provinces, there's always something highlighted from a tourism point of view. And that's the approach I think would work really well, especially with the council on board. I don't think that happens as well in Wales, where, you know, there seems to be this assumption that people come to Wales because they're rally fans. I think it's a showcase for the casual viewer to really sell the country. And I think that's something that Northern Ireland would do very well if they had the opportunity to have a go at it.
Folks, let us know your thoughts, and obviously you know where we are on Twitter, it's @Absolute_Rally on Twitter, but you can also email us studio@absoluterally.co.uk if you've got more thoughts to add on that. And yeah, I'm not just saying it because Trev's there, but all the concerns that he's just expressed, of course, that David Evans wrote about last week as well while we weren't here, I completely and utterly agree. And I've got concerns as well, and hopefully somebody can pull something out of the bag. But I'm hearing various things with regards to, you know, maybe Northern Ireland for a year, then maybe Scotland, and then maybe back to Wales as well, Trev, to be honest with you. I'm hearing that they could be trying to roll out almost like this touring event to keep it. And I don't know whether that's the answer either.
Well, certainly the promoter, you know, the managing director, Oliver Keisler, has told David Evans in the clearest possible terms that the key to Britain's future on the calendar involved a move away from Wales. So that means going to Northern Ireland, because it's the only place that could host it in 2020, as I understand it. There may be a scaremonger on their behalf. Maybe it's a negotiation tactic. I don't know. But it should be taken seriously. The people at the top of MUK, of course, are very capable of doing it and getting it sorted. But it just feels to me that the decision isn't being made, that there's no real emphasis on our... they're busy, I suppose, with the loss of Ben Taylor, that they're busy and focused on this year. They don't have a title sponsor at this point, and 6 months out, it's not likely it's going to happen. So, yeah, it's just maybe too many plates to spin, and this one isn't getting spun, and it's in danger of falling off.
Yeah, let's see. All right, Trev, sorry for hijacking your any other business. Do you have any other businesses?
No, I think that's probably it for now.
Sure.
That's a strong enough one, I think.
I think so. It'll certainly rattle a few cages. Say, folks, you can agree, you can disagree, you know how to find us. We will be all back next week. Obviously, Jack and Ryan will be back from Club Tropicana. I can't even say it now. Where the drinks are free, apparently. So they'll be back next week. We'll do a little bit more on Portugal, I guess, with those guys as well, and more on these stories as they break. It's been a great podcast. Thanks, Trev. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for doing Portugal with me.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Folks, do please spread the word. Spread the word. You know where we live now. It's @Absolute_Rally on Twitter, as I say. Facebook.com/AbsoluteRally. And you can also find all the old episodes either on Podbean, on iTunes, or on our website, which is absoluterally.co.uk. They are all there for you. Spread the love. Spread the word. We'll be back same time, same place, in your podcast hole next week.
Absolute Rally. Powered by the Kielder Works team. Spread the word. And download the podcast every week.